As Californians, we're in shock over the uncontrolled firestorms that have been eating up big chunks of Los Angeles. There's a lot we don't know. We don't know, for example, what was the immediate cause of each fire. But there are some things we do know, like the fact that Santa Ana winds are a regular, predictable feature of Southern California weather, and the fact that California environmental policy has discouraged clearing of urban adjacent wildlands, and the fact that Los Angeles recently trimmed back its firefighting budget by millions of dollars. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you today from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. We're going to talk about these factors and more as best we can on today's episode of Independent Outlook. I'm joined by several colleagues who have given thought to fire-related issues over the years. First, I'm happy to welcome Philip Magnus, holder of the David Thoreau Chair in Political Economy here at Independent. Welcome, Phil.
Happy to be here.
Also, very pleased to welcome Lawrence McQuillan, director of our Center on Entrepreneurial Innovation and author of important works on fire prevention and water policy in California. Hi, Lawrence.
Hi, Graham. Nice to be with you.
And finally, also happy to welcome Christian Fors, research fellow and director of our California Golden Fleece Awards. Let's start with Christian. Christian, you just got off a live interview with Fox News, and it's because you're an evacuee. What did Fox News want to know about your situation and how you doing?
They just wanted to know what exactly happened, what my current situation was like, who I was with, what our plans are for the future. And to briefly summarize, in California, we of course knew that there were going to be strong winds and we knew that there was a high risk of wildfire. But then the actual night of the event, it sort of blew out of proportion. I mean, these fires are worse than anyone could have ever imagined. I mean, one of the worst events in California history. So the night my grandpa and I had to evacuate, we're currently sort of on the road. I wouldn't say that we're homeless, but we're currently figuring things out.
So, well, what time of night or day was it when you had to leave?
So the fire started in Altadena in the evening. We went home around 10 p.m. to which we saw that the power had finally been cut. During the night, around like 2 or 3 in the morning, I began to get a bunch of emergency notifications. My phone was just blaring off the speakers. And then I think it was around 6 in the morning when my neighbor actually came and knocked and said, "You need to go," that I realized it was actually serious. Because sometimes, you know, you don't realize what is just an advisory warning versus like an order to go. So my neighbor came, we realized it was a very dangerous situation. We packed all of our valuables into the car, which is an incredibly humbling situation, by the way, when you're forced to choose with limited space what really matters. So we're taking paintings off the walls. And then I think around maybe 7 a.m. the next day, so maybe an hour later, we left and I haven't been back since.
Wow. And this is a home that your family's been in for, what'd you say, 4 decades or more?
40 years, yes.
Yeah. And so your grandfather, who's kind of with you today, he's probably pretty anxious to get back. Do you know if the house is still standing?
The house is still standing. Fortunately, the fires have not migrated from Altadena to La Cañada, where we live. So we don't have that to worry about, at least not yet. I do think that we do. I don't think we have property damage, but the yard has been absolutely destroyed from the winds.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, you put a human face on it. I'm just reading, you know, these statistics like, what, there's 2,000 structures have been destroyed by fire, 5 people dead. Probably hundreds, if not 1,000 some, are feeling some kind of ill medical effects. 30,000 acres or more have been burned. 400,000 plus people are without power, apparently. 130,000 or more have been ordered to evacuate. The scale of this is stunning. And of course, many of us here in California, even in Northern California, we know a lot of people in Southern California, like you, for instance. And I have friends and relatives who live down there. I have a friend whose house was burned out in Pacific Palisades. This is really pretty shocking. Although, I grew up in Orange County for at least part of my younger years, and I can remember back in the late 60s, for example, giving my age away, that it was, you know, par for the course, these big Santa Ana winds. Sometimes they were heavier, sometimes they were weaker. Every year they would come, and I remember watching the snowflakes falling, but of course they weren't snowflakes, they were embers coming from the fires to the east of us. And usually they were cold, but occasionally I would have to, or my mother would go out and spray them, you know, try and kill the embers. So this kind of thing, it's not like it's alien, but somehow it was just a bit greater magnitude of winds? I mean, here's what I want to know from Lawrence. There's the wind magnitude, which was greater, but somehow this kind of fire hit in areas that are heavily populated. Why is this different from earlier Santa Ana Fed firestorms, Lawrence, do you think?
Well, I think it's important to mention that, I mean, wildfires are very common in California. When Native Americans settled California, the estimates are about 4 million acres of California would burn every year. And now it's more around 1 million, you know, because of the prevention suppression efforts. But wildfires were common. It's nature's way of clearing out the forest of excess vegetation and providing space for new growth, regeneration of forests. So it's a very common effect. And also, as you mentioned, the Santa Ana winds too are very common. I mean, it's the short-term regular weather event down there in Los Angeles. It's not climate change. It's not anything that's unusual. It's very common. Some years, as you mentioned, worse than others. But the problem is it funnels hot desert air from the Great Basin through the mountains, which is mainly canyons. So it funnels all the air through these very short or small areas. And it just generates, you know, huge wind gusts of up to, I guess in this case, was up to 100 miles an hour in some cases. So it's really kind of formed by the geologic formation of the basin and how Los Angeles is. And then, of course, it's populated by millions of people very densely in most places, you know, densely populated. And so the wind just rips through there. And if a wildfire gets started, there's not a fire crew in the world that could stop something like that with 100 mile an hour winds, because you can't put the manpower in danger. And you can't put the aerial assets up because they can't fly in that wind gust. So you're really limited in terms of what you can do. I think the last couple of days, the LA Fire Department, County Fire Department really are just in evacuation mode, trying to save as many lives as possible, get people out. They weren't really thinking about fighting the fires right now so much because of the winds. I think that's going to change, though, probably tomorrow.
Yeah. I understood from some things I read earlier today that the Eaton Fire, which is the one that Christian has been evacuated from, got started in the adjacent wildlands just to the north of Altadena, north and maybe west of Altadena. One of the weird things about the Los Angeles area and many parts of California is that, as Lawrence noted, the population density is much greater than it was back in Native American times. However, in most of our major metropolitan areas, the metropolitan built-up areas are intersected by long sections of wildlands and parklands and mountains that are really quite close to the heavily developed areas, like Pacific Palisades. You know, it's just a stone's throw to the west, and you've got all that, you know, state land and unbuilt land and parkland, national forest, right up next to the build-up area. And then, of course, there are those canyons between West Hollywood and Brentwood in that area, which are unbuilt. So there's all these opportunities for wildfires that are not, they're in the midst of an urban area, but they're not paved. They're wild. So you've got this remarkable kind of coexistence of high-density building and very low density or wild uninhabited areas. It seems like that's a bad mixture, but I mean, it's just the topography of California.
That's right. Yeah, it is a bad mixture. As a result, it kind of divides who's responsible for what. And I think that's one of the problems is that in some cases, either people don't know who's responsible for maintaining the land, so nobody's held accountable for it, or the people who do own that land are, government bureaucrats either in Washington or in Sacramento, and they don't do the stewardship that's required to make sure that the land is properly maintained and fire mitigation practices are properly conducted like they should be. And that's been an ongoing problem in California. Just one example, Back in 2019, the state of California and the U.S. Forest Service jointly agreed to treat, and that's what's called when you remove excess vegetation, it's called a treatment. So they agreed to treat a million acres a year in California, 500,000 acres by the state, 500,000 acres by the federal government. But both since then have not met that goal or even come close in the cases of the state of California. They've only treated about 20% of that 500,000 acre per year goal every year. So they keep falling behind. One estimate is like they're 10 years. There's like a backlog now of like 10 years worth of work that they promised to do that they didn't do. And then the federal government's been a little bit better. They've done about about a half to three fifths of what they promised to do. So they have a little bit better record, but again, if you don't do this consistently, it's very easy to fall behind because then you're not only trying to go back in time and clear out what you should have done, but also there's always new growth. Maybe not so much this year because there hasn't been much rain down there, but in typical years, this is when they get their rain. And this is when the vegetation will start growing like crazy down there. And so then you have new growth that you also have to remove. So it's a constant game. If you're not committed to do this consistently every single year, you're fighting a losing battle and Mother Nature is going to take over and win eventually. As I usually say, we can either clear out the excess fuel loads from California or Mother Nature will do it for us.
Right.
It's one or the other.
Yeah, so stewardship of the land involves clearing the fuel load, as you mentioned. But this is where it can get a little pointed, and claims have been made, I'm kind of sympathetic to them, that among the bigger reasons why there hasn't been clearing and adequate stewardship is a kind of ideological commitment to a certain version of environmentalism, which makes either the state reluctant to clear out, maybe want to let nature do its thing, or private parties who own private land, they themselves may be under the influence of this rather benign idea of nature that you need to let it do whatever it wants to do. And so they don't clear and they don't exercise stewardship, not because it's too hard, but because it goes against the grain of this set of ideas. Am I exaggerating this? Any of you guys want to comment on that?
Phil?
Yeah, I mean, I can speak to that to some effect, that there's a very strong environmental activist ethos and a NIMBY, not in my backyard ethos, in California politics in particular. And if you think about it, suppose you're a homeowner and you have dead trees or accumulated growth on your property, but you can't remove that on your own without getting a permit from the government. That allows you to disturb the natural tree canopy. Suppose that you are a public entity that owns public land nearby, but every time you try to do something that would manage it in a reasonable way to forestall fires, there's an environmental group that shows up at town hall or goes to one of the state agencies and files a complaint that you are doing adverse environmental impact and just makes a regulatory obstacle to doing something that 30 or 40 years ago just would have been common sense.
Yeah, I know like in California, if you want to do like a controlled burn on your property, for example, the application process isn't that lengthy. It's about 10 to 14 days, but there's also a requirement that you need a site visit from an inspector. And that's what takes forever to get somebody to actually come out to your property and look at it. I know, like, if you compare California with, like, for example, Georgia, you can literally get a permit to burn and with one phone call in just a few minutes. So there's a big difference.
It rains in Georgia.
And it rains, yeah. And yeah, and they have forests all over Georgia. So, I mean, that really shows the difference in attitude. And a lot of it is driven by what Phil was talking about, you know, the environmental lobby. And they want to keep these forests pristine and untouched. But as a result, you know, they become overgrown and very dangerous, as we've seen.
To add on to something that you said, Graham, just talking about the ideological factors, I think there's also something about like living in the West Coast. Like, I have a friend from the East Coast, and this is an anecdote, but he said the reason why all of you West Coasters are living in La La Land is because you never experienced the snow. And I think a lot of people live in these metropolitan areas in California, and they don't realize the real risk of living so close to nature. They don't realize that they're sitting on a tinderbox. The thing that I would compare it to is imagine living next to the ocean and being completely unaware that you can have a shark attack. And when a shark attack does happen in this comparison, all of a sudden it's not one shark attack, it's a shark colony. So California, I mean, it has its ecological challenges. Like the state really wasn't meant to be settled in this capacity. Right. And we need to figure out how to be stewards of that.
Yeah. If we're going to live in California and fill it up with people, then we can't indulge in the sort of imaginative, fanciful idea that nature needs to be let to take its course. We have to cultivate and be good stewards, be good gardeners of nature, rather than allowing it to run wild if we want to put this many people right up against it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd liken it. I think the East Coast analogy is very apt. Another example would be hurricane zones. Florida, the Gulf Coast, the southeastern seaboard are all very active, susceptible hurricane zones. And this would be akin to saying, well, you can't build a seawall, or you can't replenish sand dunes, or can't take any other measures that would mitigate against this recurring known natural phenomenon that happens about the same time every year and can often come through with catastrophic effects. But there are things that we can do as human beings to mitigate that as long as we're permitted to. And if the government is standing in the way, then yeah, you're going to get predictable results of every time a disaster like this hits. It's going to be extremely costly. Lives are going to be put at risk. Property is going to be damaged.
My point a minute ago was not only is the government standing in the way of that kind of thing, but the ideas that people have and are committed to in their own minds, even on privately held property, can lead to a neglect of stewardship on private lands as part of a kind of, romantic vision, as it were. An ideology of letting nature be nature, which is, I mean, it's your own property, and I get that, but it's just unwise, incredibly unwise. But people are in the thrall of that romantic vision of the environment.
Yeah. I mean, the other problem, too, is it's just human nature. Nobody thinks this is going to happen to them.
Yeah.
Right.
Nobody thinks their neighborhood or their house is going to be burned to the ground. And so a lot of people don't, even private property owners, don't do the fuel reduction mitigation that should be done yearly, annually. And as a result, you know, even neighborhoods, like, for example, I've been watching the news and in Pacific Palisades, you know, a house will be on fire and you can barely see the house because there's just so much brush around it.
Right.
That's just a tinderbox at this point. I mean, Los Angeles hasn't had significant rainfall since March of last year. So again, but people think, oh, it's beautiful. I like it that way. It's lovely to have all this greenery and vegetation around me, and it's not going to be me until it is you. And then you realize, you know, we got a problem here. And I think that's what's happened. I mean, that's what happened in Lahaina too. I mean, nobody believes it's ever going to happen to them. So there was a lot of overgrown vegetation on private land. We could talk about that some more if we want to later on, that specifically set off the fire. It's an ongoing problem to get people to realize, not only public officials, but private citizens, you know, the urgency of dealing with this problem consistently.
Clearing out. No, you go ahead, Christian.
I was just going to say, speaking of rainfall, Lawrence, I think a lot of these people that we're referring to, the ones who, quote unquote, want to live in accordance with nature and also live in Los Angeles, it's like, okay, well, if you were living in accordance with nature, where would you get your water from? Because there wouldn't be a single water source in LA.
Yeah, right.
How many millions of people are dependent upon those incredible aqueducts coming down through the Central Valley? I mean, millions and millions of people depend upon those, not only for firefighting, but just for water and drinking and everything else you need it for.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we touched on the question of prevention. And a few years ago, Lawrence McQuillan, you authored a couple of reports under the framework of our California Golden Fleece Awards report system, which commented on California wildfires. And you laid out some laundry lists of things that can be done to mitigate the risks and then make the fires easier to contain once they do inevitably break out now and then. Of the things that you recommended in those reports a few years ago, Have any of them been meaningfully implemented, and how many have not been? Can you sort of run through a few of your ideas on prevention?
Sure. So in terms of the ones that have been implemented, you know, we recommended more aerial assets, helicopters and jumbo airplanes, fixed wing aerial vehicles that can drop huge amounts of water at one time. And Gavin Newsom, to his credit, I mean, he did buy many more helicopters and fixed wing aircraft, and those are operational now and doing a great job. Unfortunately, though, when the wind is 80 to 100 miles per hour, you can't put those aerial assets up. They are up now, fortunately. So that was a good thing. And we recommended more cameras and various infrared cameras to be deployed around the state to detect wildfires earlier. And that was done. And we also recommended, which hasn't been done at the extent that it needs to be, a couple things. One is insulating power lines and undergrounding power lines, which are the two best ways to prevent wildfires from sparks from utility poles. And then also, though, it allows the power to stay on even during a storm. Another approach is what's called a public safety power shutoff, where you turn off all the power in a geographic area, and that will solve the problem. But it's, you know, it's very inconvenient. It can be dangerous for some people who rely on power for like life support systems and that sort of thing. So that is kind of an immediate solution, but long term, what you want to do, you want to invest in either undergrounding the lines or insulating the lines, because then you can not only protect yourself from fire, but keep the power flowing during a storm. Ideally, that's the direction they should be going, and investing more and more money in that. Unfortunately, more and more money gets invested into green energy and things like that that don't provide the immediate life-saving impact that California needs. I mean, we need to take this to the next level of urgency, and insulating and undergrounding would do it. Insulating, you get about 80% of the, or 85 actually, 85% of the benefits of undergrounding lines. So you get a, you know, significant benefit from that, but undergrounding is the best, but it is expensive. Right. It's particularly expensive to repair and maintain damaged lines, because then you gotta dig them all up again. So to get to the line to fix whatever the problem is. So it is more expensive, but you know, look what happened in Lahaina. They wiped out the town, $6 billion worth of property damage. And I'm sure they would have preferred to spend the money on undergrounding and insulating power lines rather than what happened there. So those are some of the things that still need to be done. I think a lot more focus needs to be put on insulating, undergrounding power lines.
Before you leave that subject, I have a question. So I read earlier today that in addition to undergrounding and insulating, there's the question of the required margin of clearance around overground lines. And I don't know if I got this right, but I have the impression that California's regulations for clearance margins around transmission lines are narrower than federal requirements for, is that an issue that we should be concerned about?
That might be the case. I don't know. I haven't read that, but I think though increasingly power utility companies in California have moved away from this notion that they can actually get ahead of the vegetation and clear the trees away from the lines and clear the brush under the lines. And I think they've come to the conclusion that we need to insulate and underground, and just, you know, we'll do some vegetation clearing when we need to. But if you did those two things, the insulating and undergrounding of the power lines, you wouldn't have to manage the vegetation as carefully. So that would be a better solution. I mean, the other one too is that I've highly recommended in various venues is to switch to steel utility poles rather than the wooden ones, because right. There's a couple benefits. One is they're much stronger, so they can withstand much more wind force, and they won't topple as easily. And then the other one is you can space the lines out further from each other, so they're less likely to touch, because that's what usually causes, one of the main causes of wildfires is the lines touch and spark, and then the sparks set off the vegetation below and result in a wildfire. So so steel poles, for example, you can space the lines further apart, so you have less of that problem. But if you insulate the lines, and you don't really have to worry about them touching then, which is another benefit. So there's kind of, you know, six of one, a half a dozen of the other. Like, there's various strategies you can go. The most expensive, though, is to do nothing and watch your town burn to the ground and your people perish. So the best thing is to pick one of them, either public safety power shutoff, so whenever there's a red flag warning, you cut the power, or you take, and that's probably what you should do intermediately until you ramp up the undergrounding and the insulating. I know that San Diego Gas and Electric has done a very good job at undergrounding, and they're way ahead of, for example, PG&E and other utilities. So they've done a good job at that. I don't know about Southern California Edison. I know they're actively doing it, but I don't know what percentage of their transmission lines that they've actually undergrounded. I know in San Diego, it's last I saw was over 60%, close to 70%. So they're doing a very good job down there.
Yeah.
Maybe that's one reason why we haven't heard about.
That's right. It probably San Diego. Is.
I don't know if the winds went that far south or not, but yeah, they've done a good job. I think, again, you pick one of them, but do something. You can't do nothing. Otherwise, you're going to just repeat this over and over.
Well, we've been told that we need to work our way into the next century and turn green and invest in every kind of green technology. Billions of dollars, private and public incentives have been deployed toward that end. If the greatest immediate need is to say undergrounding or some of these other things, and if we don't have infinite resources, is there an implicit trade-off between the push for green and the requirements of protecting our current electricity transmission system, or can we have it all?
Well, no, you can't have it all. So you got to make choices. I don't know exactly where some of the money comes from. Some of this money comes from the federal government for green energy. It's dedicated to green energy. You probably can't use it for anything else. But there is some money that just revenues that flow into these utilities that they do have discretion over. And oftentimes, the regulators are pushing them to do green in California. Right. So they don't really have as much choice in the matter as you might think, because like the PUC is actually forcing them to do these sorts of investments, but it's the wrong way to go. It's dangerous. It's putting people's lives in peril and property. And instead that money should be devoted to preserving life and property. And the priority should be on fire resilience right now, not in anything else.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mentioned public safety power shutoffs. I was thinking, Christian, in your case, I think you told me earlier today that when the red flag warning went up, the power stayed on in your neighborhood.
Yeah, the power stayed on until far after the fires were raging in Altadena, because if power is on, my grandpa and I went to go investigate the situation, and I think we came back, and just as we came back, it went off.
Ah, okay. Well, that was a long time after the fires had been burning.
Several hours, to my knowledge.
Yeah. It's sort of like, oh, wait, close the barn door. Oops, the cows have already gotten out.
Yeah, exactly.
A little late.
But Lawrence, to add on to the conversation about the need for insulation and undergrounding versus shutoffs, the one thing I can say from my own anecdotal experience is that not having electricity and not having internet access during a crisis is debilitating. And to have sustained electricity would enable individual decision-making. One of the reasons that I ignored the emergency notifications during the night is because I didn't know the risk preferences of the decision-makers in government. Right. I don't know if this is an overreaction. And I think COVID taught us all that this is very subjective. So I'm sitting there and I'm getting 6 notifications, but I have no idea what these notifications mean. And because I don't have internet access, I can't see what where the fire is, how big it is, how close it is to La Cañada. So I was just completely helpless and subjected to follow whatever the notification said, pretty much.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's so important long-term to not use PSPSs, the public safety power shutoffs, because it's really inconvenient and dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be your only solution
in the short
run, especially for some areas like Lahaina. I think it would have been ideal because it was such a short period of time where this took place, and in a very small geographic area where they could have isolated it very temporarily and would have been spared the disaster that befell them. Whereas Los Angeles is a whole different deal because it's just so vast and there's so many people, and it would be so inconvenient and dangerous to so many people. That's why you got to start doing the insulating and undergrounding as fast as you can, so then you can both prevent the wildfires and maintain the power at the same time.
And as you've mentioned to me previously, Lawrence, I think one of the biggest issues is that if you save someone's life, they don't realize that. They only know, right. They only realize that they were inconvenienced. So sort of the economics of it is all wrong.
Yeah, it's impossible to prove a counterfactual, right? So people, even like if you shut off all the power in the LA metropolitan area, people wouldn't believe you saved their life or their property or in the neighborhood, because nobody thinks this is going to happen to them. But in this case, they should have. You know, Monday morning quarterbacking is easy, but obviously they should have. It would have prevented, more than likely, although we don't know the cause. We don't know if this was utility-based or it could be something else. But if it was utility-based, you know, PSPS would have solved the problem, but they didn't do it.
It's fascinating to see the attention being paid to this. It certainly deserved attention. It's enhanced by the fact that it's happening, at least a big part is happening, in Pacific Palisades, Santa Monica, Malibu, near Hollywood. Many of our favorite actors and actresses are literally have their homes burned out from under them and have had to get out while the flames are approaching. It's kind of stunning. And so a bunch of them have been taking to the, I would have said the airwaves in an earlier era, taking to the Twitterverse and elsewhere. Here are some comments from some famous LA celebrity types. Sarah Michelle Gellar, she says, City of LA, you want everyone to evacuate, yet you have complete gridlock and not one traffic cop on the roads helping, she said. And then here's another, I think again from X or Twitter, there's this professional dancer, Valentin Chmerkovsky, who is formerly with Dancing with the Stars. He aired his grievances saying, fifth largest economy on the planet. Firefighters didn't have enough water to do their jobs. Are you joking me? The taxes we pay for third world infrastructure is unbelievable. Come on. I'll give you one more, and then we can like analyze some of these things. So Sarah Foster, I don't know who Sarah Foster is, but I think other people do. So she wrote on X, we pay the highest taxes in California. Our fire hydrants were empty. Our vegetation was overgrown, brush not cleared. Our reservoirs were emptied by our governor because tribal leaders wanted to save fish. Our fire department budget was cut by our mayor. Apparently that part's true. $18 million was diverted from the fire budget. But thank God drug addicts are getting their drug kits, she said, Sarah Foster said. So there's a lot of grist to that mill. I'm interested in several parts of it. Like I thought this was pretty interesting when Sarah Michelle Gellar pointed out that people needed cops around to keep people from creating gridlock, but there weren't any cops. What's that about? Anybody have any insight on that? I don't.
Well, it's you're seeing the Hollywood political class is discovering some of the effects of the policies that they voted for and supported in previous years, not realizing.
What, like defund the police?
I mean, there's elements of that. There's there was a major push that I'm reading about in the LA fire departments to elevate diversity, equity, and inclusion as priorities in how to organize the department, as opposed to actually making sure it's a functional department. Now, that may not be the sole cause here, but I think it's emblematic of misplaced political priorities that have existed in the state. And the other one that I think is really going to be interesting to see is when the rebuilding efforts start. I mean, you have several of these celebrities that have multi-million dollar beachfront properties, like ideal spots, valuable real estate. And they were living in houses that were often built decades ago. Some go back to the early 20th century, rebuilding, they're going to find themselves experiencing some of the same regulatory hurdles and obstacles that a modern day developer would face in California. I mean, you have to go down and get a permit every step of the way to get lumber delivered, to get a slab poured. All of that policy accretion has occurred in recent decades through the NIMBYism of the state. It's part of the same reason why we have a housing crisis in California. It's very, very difficult to build without navigating large swaths of regulatory red tape. And the rebuilding effort itself is something that's likely going to succumb to some of the same pressures.
So that makes me predict that in the aftermath of these fires, especially with all these influential, wealthy people wanting to rebuild, there's going to be a movement to pull back some of these obstructing regulations, at least for some people in special circumstances. I just bet that's what's going to happen. Yep. Now, give me a break. I need to rebuild.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, that could be the silver lining.
Yep. It could well be.
I did a report on the medical sector, the hospital sector in California during COVID. And that was actually one of the silver linings, is in order to make the healthcare sector work in California, they had to eliminate all of these regulations and things that keep people from moving easily into the state or doing telemedicine, for example, in order to keep the healthcare system up and running during COVID. So that was actually one of the silver linings, is it revealed to everybody how burdensome and restrictive all of these regulations are that prevent things from moving smoothly. And I think another factor, as Phil mentioned, you know, all the regulatory burdens in California to rebuild is just going to be trying to get labor. Like, where are you going to find that many, you know, craftsmen to come into California and do that work when everybody's trying to rebuild at the same time? You know, that's one of the problems they had in Paradise, California, after it burned in 2018. And it still hasn't been rebuilt yet. I mean, they're still working on homes there. But that was one of the problems there, is just finding enough labor where you could actually have people on site and rebuild the house for you. So, yeah, there's a lot of obstacles like that that maybe could be lifted and hopefully permanently.
I'm just looking back a few years during COVID, Governor Newsom of California, as I recall, he waived some of the rules that restricted medical personnel from certified and
You could bring in, if you were licensed in another state, you could come into California and practice that specialty in California without having to get a California license. You could go outside the state and have telemedicine with a doctor outside the state. Unfortunately, they brought a lot of those regulations back now, but it actually showed how burdensome the medical sector regulations are in California. And I think this is going to reveal to a lot of people, especially the Hollywood elite, you know, how burdensome all of these NIMBY regulations are for construction in California. And maybe they'll be permanently lifted or eased.
Maybe the crisis in this case will result in reduction of regulation rather than increase of regulation. That would
be permanent reduction.
Let's hope it's permanent. Our colleague Mary Thoreau pointed out to me this morning that after the 1991 Oakland Hills fire, which was very extensive, 2,800 homes destroyed and so forth, 25 people killed, the mayor then, who was Elihu Harris, he established a storefront thing, a one-stop shop, as it were, for contractors to get permits, schedule inspections, everything quickly done so they could rebuild. It was really smart. And I'm sure they need to do that, but maybe it needs to be just broader. I mean, let's wake up and realize that we need this kind of liberty to rebuild after all sorts of things, not just the current crisis.
It's funny when there's a crisis and the government all of a sudden allows all these things, and you realize that it was in their power the entire time to allow these things to happen.
Why was it there to begin with?
Okay. Then another thing that was touched on, one of these quotes that I made from the celebrities firefighters didn't have enough water, and taxes we pay. Where were the firefighters? Why did they reduce the budget? I'm just going to play you really quickly here a little clip from an interview with Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass when she landed at LAX, when she returned from Ghana in the middle of this fire crisis. This has been, it's gone viral. Apparently millions have seen this. It's pretty interesting, and we can analyze it after I'd let you take a peek at it here.
Do you owe citizens an apology for being absent while their homes were burning? Do you regret cutting the fire department budget by millions of dollars, Madam Mayor? Have you nothing to say today? Have you absolutely nothing to say to the citizens today?
Well, you get the gist of it.
Wow.
You get the gist of it. Yeah, it was pretty embarrassing for her. And apparently the details are that early in her tenure, she advocated and then was implemented a shift in budget and budgeting funds of $18 million out of the firefighting budget and into homelessness initiative efforts. Homelessness, of course, has grown, as have fires. To what extent have budgetary priorities like that, like shifting money out of the firefighting budget, contributed to the problem this week?
Well,
probably none of you really know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the specifics of the LA budget, but I would say that you obviously, I mean, you want to maintain a sufficient number of fire crew so that you could confront any emergency that should flare up. I don't know exactly what the force is or how much it's been cut or anything like that, but you obviously don't want to divert too much money from something like that or any money. I don't think, though, there's a fire crew in the world again that could have, you know, suppressed this fire. It just got out of hand so quickly. But they do have, according to the governor, they have over 2,000 firefighters there on site right now in Los Angeles.
Yeah, if LA was short, they certainly have backfill.
Yeah,
from
the U.S. Forest Service, they got extra crews from them. And remarkably, that the U.S. Forest Service right now is actually fully staffed, which is actually really rare. So they got their allotment from the federal government for this. I think, though, where you will notice the impact is after the winds die down and you're trying to actually suppress these fires and extinguish them permanently, and they're so vast across such a large area, that's when you're going to need a lot of boots on the ground to do that work, and you don't want to have it rekindle. So you want to make sure somebody stays there and make sure it's permanently out. That's where numbers are really going to matter, and they probably will want to have even more people there than they do now, because now they're kind of more in what they call a front follow mode, where you just kind of follow the fire along and try to get people out as quickly as you can from where the fire is headed. But once they get out in front of these fires, after the winds die down, then it becomes a suppression extinguish mode. And so then you're going to want a lot of people. And that's kind of what I worry about is, I think these fires are going to rekindle, and you're going to have fires for weeks down there in some parts, because there won't be enough people, or there won't be enough water, as we found out, or they just don't have the men and machinery to cover such a vast area. And so I think they'll be fighting fires for a long time down there.
And if so, I think that the city may well regret having shrunk its firefighting budget by $18 million.
Yeah, I agree.
I guess time will tell. The other thing that was mentioned by, however, one of these celeb tweets that I was mentioning before was the one, Sarah Foster, our reservoirs were emptied by our governor. how could we run out of water in the middle of the fire? You and I were talking about this earlier, Lawrence. I think your comment was that the reservoirs weren't empty.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yeah. All but one of the Southern California reservoirs are above where they usually are on this date. So they're not empty. They have plenty of water. The problem is that, for example, in Pacific Palisades, they have three tanks, each of 1 million gallons of water. But you had every fire engine tapping into the same system at the same time to extinguish the fire, and they just ran out of water in those three tanks. And it takes a while, and as a result, they have no water pressure then because it's gravity fed, so that the water creates the water pressure itself. So they had to refill the tanks, which takes time. My recommendation would be to establish reservoirs or tanks closer to LA. So take the water from the reservoirs, bring it closer to the city so that it could be used more quickly in an emergency, and increase the throughput through the water system that feeds the hydrants. I mean, that would be the logical approach, I think, and kind of have it as a collaborative community-wide endeavor, so not one community or town is on the hook for the entire bill, because it could be something they would all share depending on where the situation, where the emergency was. But I think having, you know, more of a water supply closer to where the urgent emergency is, and being able to feed it quicker through the pipes to the hydrants would be a good solution. I will imagine that when they rebuild Paradise, or not Paradise, but Pacific Palisades, just like when they rebuilt Paradise, is they undergrounded all of the power lines, and they're going to probably have a much more sophisticated water system when they rebuild that has more hydrants and more of a throughput through the hydrants when it is a time of emergency. I'll bet you that
nearby storage.
Yeah, they reinforce both of those going forward with greater capacity.
But Lawrence, this is California, and any increase in both water storage capacity and water delivery capacity is going to have environmental impacts, and it's going to be slowed down by the environmental impact contest process. Maybe this crisis could overcome that inertia. What do you think?
Well, I mean, we can be hopeful, right? I know that, you know, there's a bond passed years ago. I think it was like a $6.4
billion
bond to build more reservoirs. As far as I know, not a drop of additional water has come from that bond yet. There's just been constant fighting and environmental impact reports being written and evaluated and litigated. It's just a nonstop bureaucratic environmental lobby nightmare. So not a single drop of water has emerged from those. And, you know, we can be hopeful that they build those and that they get more water delivered throughout the state where it needs to go. I'm ever hopeful. So I remain hopeful, Graham.
Well, that's good. I mean, Californians do need more water. And the water is there to be collected and distributed.
Right. Yeah. Right now, millions of gallons flows out to the ocean every year. They just don't capture it.
Right. Yeah. And so it's the irony is in all of these big fire events, not just this one, but the past recent ones in recent years, is that for the sake of environmental values and concerns, many efforts at water and other matters have been blocked because prevent damage to the environment, but then it makes us more vulnerable to fires. There's less water, there's less delivery of water, there's more brush because we didn't clear it because of respecting the environment and the natural habitats. So for the sake of protecting the environment, we ended up having massive damage to the environment by these huge fires.
Right, right.
And so it seems to me that just like common sense trade-offs are not being made.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, and fires, wildfires emit so much more toxic
CO2,
particulates,
and everything else is burning.
Yeah, it's far less healthy than a power plant that emits CO2 and particulates. Wildfires are the worst. It's
terrible.
It's terrible.
And in urban wildfires are especially bad because they're burning not only trees and bushes, but also all sorts of plastics and petroleum derivatives.
And rubber and plastic. Yeah, you name it, it gets burned. And then people inhale that. It's extremely bad for people's health.
Yeah, and but not only people, but I mean, the breakout of these fires in all these urban adjacent wildlands is devastating for the fauna,
wildlife,
the animals
yeah,
who live there,
absolutely,
the wildlife that lives there. So we, it's not so simple as saying, oh, well, we got to value people more than fish species.
Right. And the amount of CO2 released from these wildfires recently has surpassed all the abatement efforts in the same amount of time. So it's a negative win for California. They'd be better off targeting the wildfires than they would be targeting the power plants and that sort of thing.
With reference to what you said earlier, Graham, about people being frustrated about this reservoir situation, I think a lot of it stems from the fact that at its core, the government is almost like a Hobbesian social contract between us. We pay for certain for the provision of certain services like police, like fire, basic services which we expect.
Why not?
And I think people in California, they were willing to tolerate the nonsense and like high taxes and sort of misappropriation of spending on things that people didn't necessarily agree with, because there was the assumption that at its core, it will take care of us.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden, when you remove the Band-Aid and a crisis happens and the government's misperformance, like, okay, well, what on earth have I been paying for this whole time?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If I may just talk about the Lahaina fire briefly, because it ties into what Christian mentioned, is where the fire ignited was on private property owned by a private school. And both in 2019 and in 2020, they were cited for excessive vegetation and not maintaining a 30-foot fire break that they were supposed to maintain. So they had two violations in back-to-back years, and nobody followed up with them. So they never cleared the excessive vegetation for the fire happened in 2023. So for 4 years, they never cleared the vegetation and they never created a fire break for these 4 years. And the county never followed up. So again, this gets back to what Christian was saying. People expect that government is doing their job to protect you when they're really not. And when they find out, they get especially angry about it and their eyes become wide open to the effects. So when the county fire chief was asked about this in an October 2023 news conference, he said, well, we don't get paid to babysit these lots. Well, enforcing the notice is as important as issuing the notice. So somebody has to go back and make sure that the work is actually done. And for 4 years, they never did it. And that's exactly the spot where the fire erupted and ended up burning down the entire town.
Wouldn't somebody have to
babysit these enforcement measures. And that was his job. He didn't do it. Obviously, people are angry with him. There's a lot of lawsuits over it. As you can imagine, they're probably
in Lahaina. We're talking
Lahaina. So, that's just a great example of what Christian was saying, is that people put up with a lot until their own personal safety is at stake. And people now are wide open and realize how government hasn't been doing its job, even on the safety aspect of things.
Right. Now, I'm thinking the rebuilding process will, God willing, start to occur within a few months after this is all tamped down. During the rebuilding process, could it be an opportunity for people to recognize not only that regulations, government permits need to be scaled back, but also could it be an opportunity for private responsibility to be ramped up in new ways? For example, earlier today, Lawrence, you commented to me that in some of these densely packed with trees, dense vegetation neighborhoods like Pacific Palisades, had there been a homeowners association, then there could have been much more attention paid to the private responsibility, not the governmental responsibility, but the private responsibility to clear your land. How could HOAs help in the future in these kind of densely vegetative urban environments?
Well, I live in an HOA, and as I mentioned earlier today, that if I have one weed in my yard, I'll get a letter in the mail about it. So, HOAs do a very good job in their property. They usually hire a property manager at monitoring, inspecting the neighborhood, the yards, making sure everybody is compliant with the regulations. So if there had been an HOA or multiple HOAs in Pacific Palisades, the management company would have cited all of these homeowners And
oh, they were all overgrown.
Yeah, excessive dry vegetation in your land. You have to, in your yard, and you have to clear it. And it would have happened. They would have submitted a bill to them and their annual fees, and they would have tacked that on to, or even put a lien on the property if they refused to pay it. But because they tell you in the letter, because you know you have a contract with the HOA when you buy the house, that if you don't do it, we'll do it for you, and then you'll get a bill, and it's going to be much higher than the bill that you would have paid if you did it on your own. They should have had that in Lahaina. If they would have had a HOA in these neighborhoods, they would have forced them. You wouldn't have had to rely on the county then to do it, because they didn't. The county didn't do it. So, but the HOAs, I promise you, they watch these things very carefully, and they enforce the rules. And if you don't pay or comply, you're not going to be living there very long.
Right.
Well, maybe some of our, you know, famous celebrity homeowners in these areas, as they're trying to figure out what to do next, could get together with one another and form these new voluntary compacts and protect their neighborhoods.
Well, the Independent Institute has a book called Voluntary City. And in there, there is a chapter about Robert Nelson wrote it, about how to convert your neighborhood into an HOA. And I think everybody, you know, should look at that. Go on our website, buy the book, and it's called Voluntary City. You know, read about that if you're interested, because it can be done. I don't know what the rules are specifically in California. excuse me, but it can be done. And so hopefully that kind of gets going after this, and maybe we'll see more of that. I don't know how cumbersome it is to do in California. I'm assuming it is difficult, because everything's more difficult in California to do in terms of regulation and permits and all that. But I would definitely look into it. HOAs are just very popular. I mean, if people have a choice, the surveys show that if people have a choice between an HOA and a non-HOA property to buy, they'll pick the HOA. You know,
it preserves the value better.
It restricts you a little bit in terms of what you can do in terms of painting your house yellow or something that you really want to do. But so you might not be able to do that, but it also restricts everybody else, and it keeps the home values, the property values, the safety, all much improved over a conventional, traditional neighborhood.
Oh, let's take it a step further. What if in these neighborhoods there was not only the HOAs with regard to maintenance issues, but what if there were public security cooperatives? Mm-hmm. Then there would have been people around prowling the streets who could have prevented the gridlock as people escaped. Right. There would have been traffic cops, but non-governmental traffic cops.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Eyes on the ground rather than
like
someone sending a decision from City Hall.
Yeah,
exactly.
Same thing, Christian Mission. There's the boy that cried wolf phenomenon that goes on when alerts are appearing every hour all night. You don't know if that person's on the ground seeing it or if it's some bureaucrat 20 miles away.
But if it's your own local, private security force, then you can take it much more seriously. Now,
just
somebody
just one
could
point,
say,
Graham, is when I lived in Sacramento, our HOA did have two security patrols constantly, 24 hours a day, seven days a week. And they patrolled the neighborhood both for safety and for anybody who needed help, car broken down or whatever. But it was great because you got to know the people, you knew their names, you said hi to them when they drove by, when you were mowing your lawn, you had their cell number, you could actually call them. It was just a really great situation, and you knew that somebody was patrolling it 24/7. And in a case like you mentioned, Graham, they could provide traffic services if need be. I mean, thankfully, that never happened there. In Sacramento, the problem is more about a flood because it's surrounded by levees. It has more levees, I think, than any city other than New Orleans. So it's very much like New Orleans, where so you're more likely to be have a flooding problem than a fire problem there. But again, private security could also provide private traffic, flows.
Exactly.
Make sure the traffic keeps moving. Although, this situation was you know, unprecedented in some respects. So,
of course,
yeah, the people mm-hmm. were really trapped in some situations.
Yeah, nothing could have prevented it from being painful. Yeah. Although, as we've discussed, a number of measures and policies, had they been adopted over the past decades, could have made it less extreme
than
it has proved to,
absolutely.
Proved to be. Yeah, really could have. So we're kind of at the end of our discussion here. Two things I wish I could fit in quickly. One is the question of insurance. And then when we get done with that, and I'll ask Phil about that, when we're done with that, I just want to come back to Christian and see what the next steps are for him before we say goodbye. But on insurance, so mostly what I hear is that these big, bad insurance companies in California, they're not renewing policies, and so people can't get insurance, and so that's really terrible. Shouldn't we force these insurance companies to offer policies here, Philip, so that people could get insurance?
Well, there's the same problem. It's an existing bad regulatory environment that has driven the insurance market away from the state. You know, their market signals are disrupted by the fact that the government has come in, and they'll do things like they'll cap insurance payments. They'll limit competition. There are all sorts of mechanisms through the regulatory devices of the state that just make it a very unappealing insurance market. And therefore, what do private firms do? They just decide, hey, we're going to wash our hands of California, and they pull out.
So you know, you're saying it's not just that they're big, mean corporations, but that the California regulators hamstring them to such a degree that they pull out.
That's exactly it. And you're hearing anecdotes about this in Pacific Palisades, people that lost their fire insurance or their homeowners insurance 6 months ago, all because of the regulatory environment of the state.
But they would have had to pay higher rates had the state not capped the rates.
Well, and there's the question. I think almost every one of them, if you polled them today, would voluntarily and willingly
absolutely.
Have paid a higher rate. It's the
absolutely.
Same thing. If you live on the coast in a hurricane zone, you should expect to pay higher rates.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
when your home is gone, you are going to be wishing that you paid that higher rate.
Right. Oh, man. Again, another instance where the government regulation has just throttled what would have been an adequate provision of insurance.
And once again, I think that there's just testaments to the fact that people living in places like Los Angeles are just disconnected from the reality of the place which they're actually located.
Yeah.
Like I know a lot of people in my hometown, just other parts of California, that claim that the insurance companies are ripping them off because their rates were raised. Well, first of all, their rates weren't really raised because, like you said, it's capped through a variety of regulations. And there's also prohibitions on catastrophe modeling, which right. were very recently changed. But for the longest time, insurance companies could only – like they could only price your insurance policy based on 20 years of historical data. So if you are living in an area surrounded by brush – but a fire has never happened, even though it's incredibly likely, the insurance company needs to act like there's no risk involved pretty much.
Wow.
But just to talk about that disconnect, it's like people complain about the rates, but it's like you don't realize like the insurance company is not scamming you. If anything, you're a financial liability to them. You should be glad that you have any insurance to begin with.
So, okay. A lot more to be said on this topic. I'm sure we're all going to be following this news closely. I'm keeping in touch with friends and relatives. I'm sure that all of us are doing that. And Christian, most of all, where are you going to sleep tonight?
We are still figuring that out. We stayed at a hotel last night. I'm using this church currently so I can continue my work. Perhaps
for which I thank you.
Oh, yeah, yes, no problem. Perhaps another hotel tonight. The issue is, you know, I think everyone else somehow miraculously has more family and friends in the Los Angeles area than my family does. So everyone else seemingly found somewhere. So we're just going to play it day by day, see what happens. But we'll have to find somewhere.
Yeah. I'm so sorry you had to go through this. Boy, oh boy. But I'm grateful that you're giving us a kind of a first-person account of what it's like. And now you've got to go, when we're done here, you can go reassure your grandfather and your cat, right? They're both waiting for you, I think.
Yes, both of them.
Okay, good. Thank you so much for being with us, Christian. Philip Magnus, thank you for being with us, Phil. Also, Lawrence McCullough, I'm so grateful for your deep research in this area. I invite all of our friends to visit our website, independent.org, where we've got a treasure trove of resources on these and other subjects. Keep in mind, especially what Lawrence McQuillan recommended, find our book, The Voluntary City, which really could give some pretty good pointers for people trying to rebuild a California after this crisis. Okay, we're keeping a good thought for all of our friends down south, and we thank you for joining us on Independent Outlook. Take care, everybody.
All right.